telling a joke and I didn't start the, all right. I like to give the internet the impression that I'm funny. The illusion. About this time, in retreats I've been to, and my experience is that there'll be what is known as persistent visitors, which are thoughts and feelings that we think we've made room to listen to and feel, the feelings that need to be felt, the stories that need to be heard. And then it's like, really? You again? If you've ever had yummy, 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 I've got love in my tummy stuck in your head. Which I have. And please don't analyze it. Especially Pablo, please don't analyze that one. So sometimes it's really silly stuff like that that keeps coming up, keeps lodging. But then other times it's like my brain is sounding like a, you know, a John Lennon song or Jim Morrison, like, Daddy, I want to kill you. Mommy, you didn't love me. And that can get lodged in there too. The nobody loves me. And but for today, it's been, holy shit, I have to give a talk again in front of Noah. There's few people that's been more important in my spiritual life than basically Noah, Ajahn Jeff, and Ajahn Susito. And thankfully, I'll never have to give a talk in front of the latter two because they never let me. They'd never be so silly. But Noah keeps on indulging the idea. So I found that when persistent visitors come up, it's for me, and feel free to use this or not, something's obsessively, repetitively lodged in my head. It's like sharing an office for me with a coworker who keeps on thinking that the world is about to end. And every day or every moment they come in telling me that same story. And there's a temptation to argue with it. And it's, in my experience, those voices do not listen to reason because it's my mom from 35, 40 years ago. You know, so they're immune to logic. I've tried to close the door and shut them out. And they bang really loudly until it's worse. So for me, what works sometimes after a lot of practice is making the room, the office, as comfortable and as spacious as I can. I say hello to every moment or every day or whatever, every hour, every 15 minutes, however frequently that visitor is coming back, I say hello. I don't try to lock the door, but I don't listen again to the story about how the world's going to end. I simply say, you're allowed to sit over there and shout and tell me the stories, and I'm going to make myself really comfortable over here. I've given you already a lot of attention. First 2 or 3 days, maybe, of a retreat, you know, maybe it's been 3 days. It doesn't matter. I've heard the story, given the feelings, the attention that needed to be felt, but there then comes a time to like refocus on something else, and I just give it permission to be there. And eventually, it sees often enough that it's not going to get my attention, and it will leave. Sometimes I have to give it a little bit more love. Sometimes it just doesn't feel it's been loved or it's been paid attention to. So I give it a little more attention, but there always comes a time eventually where I have to just move on and get the rest of my work done. So it's been wonderful hanging out with Noah and Pablo. One of the best things for me is the when I get to hear other Dharma teachers, you get to get the gold of this Dharma job, which is a good story. That's really what matters. The Dharma's good too, but getting a good story that you can reuse and sort of by not giving credit, you pretend that it was your great story. So it's really great to hear these talks because now I've gotten a few more gold bricks to lay on other people. There's a story about the Inuit up in way northern territories. The Inuit chief has died, and his son or daughter has inherited the chief mantle. And the most important thing in their job is that they have to foretell what the weather is, predict the weather, forecast the weather, because it's very important to know if it's going to be really stormy or if they're going to be able to go out and hunt for, I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about, for walruses. Because I am an expert on Inuit culture. So that's really important. So they asked the new chief, so what's it going to do? Is it going to be really cold and stormy, or is it going to be warm enough for us to go out? And he just wings it and says, going to be warm for a while. Going to be warm. We can build the crafts, get them ready, you know, get the kayaks, you know, ready to go out to sea. So get them all ready. Again, the next week, they ask him the same question. He's like, yeah, he's trying to figure it out, look at the clouds. He has no idea. He's just guessing and going by, you know, sometimes old wives' tales or whatever. He's going by what he's heard. And he says, yeah, it's going to be warm. It's going to be okay. Get the kayaks ready. Finally, he gets nervous and he calls up the National Weather Service. And he says, is it going to be warm or is it going to be cold and stormy? And they say, hold on for a second. The person waits, and the person on the other end says, waits, and then gets back on the phone and says, yeah, it's going to be warm. Whew, release. Ah, verified. So another week passes. They ask him again. And it's like, we're just about ready to go out. We got all the kayaks ready, all the whatever, harpoons, and nets, because that's what you use with walruses. I don't know. And where am I going with this? Anyway, so he gets asked again. He says yes, and now he's really nervous. And he runs screaming to the telephone. He calls up the National Weather Service again. He's like, gets the same person on the line, and he says, you know, listen, I really got to know for certain. Is it going to be warm, or is it going to be, you know, cold and stormy? Person on the other end of the line, the National Weather Service person says, hold on, let me check again. And comes back and says, yeah, it's going to be warm. And he goes again, but he's still nervous. And he says, can I ask how you know? Like, how do you really know? And the guy says, well, my friend's been checking out the Inuits and they got all their kayaks ready. That's the way these stories work. I was once at a... You're getting no Dharma tonight. You're just getting a... No, I was at a workshop with my friend Craig Swager and the great, wonderful teacher Tara Brach was teaching, and she said at one point, the Buddha invited Mara, the king of... basically, Mara is that impulse to find lasting happiness in the world, in our jobs, our careers, our relationships. And Mara is the thing that tempted the Buddha to give up the spiritual path upon his enlightenment. And Tara Brach was giving us a lesson along the lines of the fire-eating demon. And you know what the anger-eating demon is. You know what that story is? Just basically, if you're confronted by something scary inside, if we greet it with aversion, you know, throw anger at the anger-eating demon, it just gets bigger. But King Sakka greeted the anger-eating demon with patience and with kindness and compassion, and the anger-eating demon shrunk until it became something that could be let go of, disposed of from the throne that it was inhabiting. So much of our fear and our anger is anger-eating demons. It feeds off of our aversion. So Tara Brach was telling a similar story, and she said, the Buddha invited Mara in for tea. And I looked at my fellow Dharma junkie, Craig, and I was like, we gave each other this. She didn't. Oh, no, she didn't say that. And so we both went later that night because, you know, it doesn't matter. It was a great lesson on how to relate to temptation and the feeling that, oh, no, I can't do the work. I have to go back and think about my job, how to relate to those feelings. So never mind that. Later on that night, I went screaming back to the online Pali dictionary, looking up the words of the Buddha. Where did he say this shit? Where did he say this? Craig's doing the exact same thing. He gave up, but I'm more obsessive. And I finally traced it back to Thich Nhat Hanh, who in the 80s was telling that story as a wonderful example. Thich Nhat Hanh was heard by Sharon Salzberg, who started telling the story. I suspect it was heard by Cornfield, because Cornfield was then is Brock's teacher, mentor. So it got passed on, and now it's official that the Buddha invited Mara in for tea. And for a while, I was outraged. Now I love the story and tell it. Because it doesn't matter. So, those persistent, obsessive, those voices I've got to work out the dramas at work. I've got to figure out my relationships. I've got to deal with this family crisis, all that stuff. It's very, very loud. It's very, very persistent. And finding moments of peace can be very challenging because they're not as loud. They're much subtler. So we need to be very patient. Very, very patient. And learn to focus the mind and be relaxed until we stay long enough with something that doesn't bring us that feeling of security, I'm going to be taken care of, that doesn't bring us this feeling, that, you know, at first it doesn't bring us this feeling that it's going to solve everything, but then after a while it does, it changes. I'll give you an example, exercise. You may not know it, but I actually exercise. I mean, it's not apparent, but... But, you know, the first 20 times I exercised, I stood in the mirror and I said, where are the muscles? That's supposed to be a funny face. Probably did a funny face yesterday, and so did Noah, so I'm trying to do a funny face. Where's the muscles? And, of course, they won't show up very early. It takes a lot of patience and effort for something that's truly going to pay off in the long term to show up. I started skateboarding when I was 44 years of age. 12-year-olds were smirking. They rode by. There's nothing I hate more than being smirked at by 12-year-olds. I'm not a huge fan of 12-year-olds to begin with. I didn't like myself when I was 12, and here's a 12-year-old smirking as he goes wheeling by doing a, you know, I didn't even bother to learn the things, but I'm on my skateboard. It was humiliating for me, and it took a lot of time and patience and willing to suck before I got comfortable just pedaling around. And I'll never be somebody who can, you know, do the tricks. But I can get from A to B now on my skateboard and back without running into a car. And that's a major triumph. And that's for me what a lot of the spiritual path has been like, with working with the breath, with the body, working with practice. So along the way, before we literally try practice, I'm going to talk as much as I can in the first person. I tried a lot of other things for lasting peace, to soothe the mind, because like everybody else, I felt like I had a very busy life with a lot of stuff going on in it, and I really needed something to soothe and turn off the mind, because I was filled with anxiety. A lot of depression, a lot of worry, and a lot of feeling that I wasn't going to be taken care of. So I looked to a lot of things to soothe and turn off the mind. They were often, at the beginning, they were very unskillful. I went from pot to heroin and coke in a matter of a few years. I was in my first hospital detox when I was 19. So I tried the things that really work really quickly to soothe and turn off the mind. You know, and I went straight into that. And eventually, after a lot of time, I crashed and burned. And I finally saw that this was not going to be the lasting, soothing, turn off the mind, bring tranquility, bring some sense of okayness, a sense of inner, you know, I'm okay. It wasn't going to allow me to deal with the feelings that need to be felt in a way that was safe. It wasn't accomplishing anything. So then I started looking for things that would be reliable and lasting and give peace in progressively more skillful places. First, after I was newly sober, I started shopping. I had no money. I was bankrupt, so this was a particularly bad idea. And not remarkably skillful. And very quickly, I realized that this was not a sustainable habit, that little thrill you get when you spend something on your credit card and they look at you with, oh, yes, you're another human being. We love you. You're okay. Yes, you can afford this. It means that you're good. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm good. You see? If you have no idea what I'm talking about, that's okay. Then I saw that didn't work, so I moved on to, you know, if you're newly sober and you've gone through everything hard, then you try to sleep with as many people as you possibly can. And that didn't work because not that many people wanted to sleep with me. In fact, they didn't want to have sex with me either. So I went through those, and those things too turned out to be not reliable and not bringing any lasting peace. So eventually, I got to more and more skillful things. I actually started on a quest to learn as many musical instruments as humanly possible. I now can play the banjo, the accordion, and the trumpet, which no human being should really want to ever do, because if you've ever even sat in a room with an accordion, which I urge you not to, but one side has got buttons, one side's got a keyboard, you got to keep pushing and pulling in and out of things, and they don't even work the same way. And even if you get good at it, people are going to go,
He plays the accordion.
So eventually that ability to turn off my mind and be something that brought me a sense of worthiness and permission to relax and not worry about the future, that stopped working. So I was driven. Is this slow enough? Noah always gives me one good piece of advice. He said, slow. Because I'm a speed talker. We've got a podcast, and like I sometimes listen to it, I'm like, oh my God. That guy's got a lot to say, but so I was driven to it. The Buddha's first great observation was that we are all going to age, sicken, and die. That's what the entire spiritual path is based on. At this point in my notes, I have the word Chaw's chicken written down. Like Babo said last night, BDSM. I have Chaw's chicken written down. Luckily, I'm a professional, so I know what that refers to. More people that were new to teaching wouldn't have a clue, but I'm actually going to read you from one of my favorite pieces by Ajahn Chah. He says, we live like a chicken who doesn't know what's going on. In the morning, it takes its baby chicks out to scratch and search for food. In the evening, it goes back to sleep. The next morning, it goes out, and its owner has scattered rice for it to eat, but it doesn't know why it's being fed. The chicken and its owner are thinking in very different ways. The owner is thinking, how much does this chicken weigh? The chicken, though, is engrossed in the food. That's all it's thinking about. When the owner picks up the chicken to feel its weight to see if it's ready, the chicken think, oh, I'm being shown affection. We too don't know what's going on. We don't know how many more years we'll live. The king of death is like the owner of the chicken. We don't know when he'll catch up with us because we're engrossed with the sights, the sounds, the smells, the sensations, and the ideas about our day-to-day life. So the Buddha saw that when he was in his 20s. And unlike most of us who were like, yeah, I get it, I'm going to die. He got it in a very, very deep, deep, profound way. That there's no guarantee. That this thing we call life is, or this human body, let's put it that way, doesn't come with guarantees. It's not going to last forever, and it's not going to be the source of lasting peace and tranquility. So he launched too on the spiritual path, and he went through a series of teachers, Dhaka Ramaputra, Alira Kalamas. He did a lot of the work, and still he didn't find the answer. He looked everywhere he could. He hung out with Jains, who are very severe practitioners, pretty weird, hold their hands up for months on end till the muscles start withering. Don't recommend it. But he did all kinds of stuff, looking in all kinds of places. He too jumped around looking for one thing after another that would bring him lasting peace. He wasn't quite as weirdly unskillful as I. He didn't try buying 12 ukuleles. True, Pablo, I bought 12 ukuleles, one spur. I have to sell them off. So he eventually found or saw through just how much of the things that we attach to for happiness are in fact both not reliable and don't give satisfactory tranquility, peace, relief, a feeling of being okay in the body, a feeling of being okay in the mind, a feeling of being able to be with difficult feelings and very, very painful stories in the mind. Some of us just keep on going, looking from one thing to another, and it gets progressively worse. It reminds me of the story of the Greek fisherman who's very content in his lot. He's a Greek fisherman. That sounds pretty good to me. But he lives in the islands, and he's very happy in his life. And a businessman comes to him and says, "You know, I've got a great idea for you. Wouldn't it be great if you bought another boat so that you could catch twice as much fish?" And the fisherman says, "Well, with what money?" The businessman says, "No worries, we'll get you a loan. You know, and in like 5 or 10 years, you'll pay off the loan, then you'll have two boats." And the fisherman says, "Oh, really?" And then the businessman says, "And then you can buy two more. You'll have soon a whole fleet of Greek fishermen boats." And then the fisherman says, "Okay, well, then what I do?" And then the owner says, "Well, then we can open up a stand with a fish market right by that, and then a restaurant, and then you'll have also like a t-shirt stand." Think about how much money you'll be making then with your restaurant, your fleet of boats, and all this stuff. You'll be reaping it in. Everything will be great. And the fisherman says, "Oh, wow, so now I'm running all this stuff. What do I do then?" And the guy says, "Well, then you'll probably just retire to a little fisherman boat and live off the isle, just doing fishing in your one boat." It never occurs to the businessman that the fisherman already has all that. It never occurs to us that we already have everything we need to find happiness. So often there's a voice in our head that says, "I need to get another boat. I need to get a different roommate, a different job, a different this." The happiness is always out there. And so we cling on to something else, attach to something else, and we shake it and try to get the, like Pablo was talking about the sunset. We stumble upon a sunset. The sunset passes, and then we try to feed off the memory of the sunset and try to figure out a way to bring up another sunset in the middle of the night. We cling. Actually, the word for clinging is upadana. It really means feeding. We try to feed off of something that's not meant to sustain us. So one by one, we find that our worrying, our planning, our the things that we're attaching to, the things that we are desperately, the jobs, the careers, learning the accordion, you know, the skateboarding, eventually we still wind up with that feeling of either I'm lonely, I'm incomplete, there's something wrong, I can't settle into my body, I can't be comfortable in my mind, so there's something wrong with this thing. It's this thing's fault, it's the world's fault, I just have to find the next thing. Now the problem is what's happening is that these things, there's nothing inherently wrong with it, it's what our demands are unreasonable. Our demands are unreasonable. We're trying to get something out of a job or a relationship, you know, that it's not meant to give us. It's not meant to give, to answer that feeling in my mind that I'm not lovable. Because that feeling's in here, it's not in the world. The best job in the world cannot go in here and fix that. So it's unsatisfactory and it's unreliable in terms of answering that deep need. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with those things, and it doesn't mean we can't enjoy them. But once we expect this thing to be the answer, it is going to disappoint us. And that will be dukkha or suffering or stress or whatever you want to call it. So we get, hopefully, rather than unlike me in my younger life, driven towards progressively shorter, quicker term satisfactions until we're lingering over the crack pipe or whatever. Hopefully we'll be driven towards progressively more skillful things. When I was first sober and out of rehab, I sat with a person who was at a 12-step meeting, and they said, I'm really upset today because I meant to have a decaf tea and I drank a caffeinated tea. And I'm right off of drinking, you know, literally, I don't want to tell you I'm still drinking, you know, I don't want to lose your, but it was a painful amount. And I thought, fuck this. This person's complaining about tea, caffeinated tea. I'm here, you know, I've just blown up my life. I have nothing, you know, I'm like shaking out of this stuff. I have to tell you that now 17 years later, if I have a caffeinated tea at night, forget sleeping. Really, with sitting here talking in front of Noah, I would be more comfortable wearing a diaper. Just want to put that out there. A little pink diaper. Smearing my feces on the wall. I feel better. Okay. So the value in seeing a Nietzsche is that the value in seeing a Nietzsche is a couple. One, it's an antidote for clinging. It actually is something that if we reflect on, each time we get bent out of shape and really worked up by wherever we're working or the relationship or the feeling that if only I could fix this person, everything would be okay, then there's that feeling of, oh, wait a second, I've already seen that trying to fall into that fantasy that if I fix him, her, it, or just perfect this relationship, that it'll all be okay. I've already seen that. And it gives me more, as Noah uses the word, permission. And I got to work on saying that in a way that I can own it. Permission to drop that endeavor, which is so built into our minds. Right? We're hardwired to a certain degree to look for happiness and security out there. That's the way the brain is actually set up, the way the dopamine is released, the cortisol, the, you know, don't get me started on the neuroscience, it's set up to look and to find. The only problem is the brain was set up to survive the way the world was 50,000 years ago, which is when the brain last stopped evolving. And the world was a really fucked up, dangerous place, and we had to monitor what was going on around us and look for security constantly out there. But we don't have to do that anymore. There's not tribes of people out to kill us any moment. Although every time I look there, I think there is. But seriously, we're not in that danger, but the brain is still hardwired to survive the way the world was very, very, very many years ago. So it takes a lot of, you know, trial and error, and we need to get the permission from our experience of seeing, oh shit, this isn't working, to continually again and again and again have that clinging and that desperation and that over-involvement in things in the world to finally give it permission to go. We're also less disappointed the more we truly see how these things we're asking too much and that they're unreliable in terms of meeting this deep need to turn off the mind, to find inner peace, to answer that voice of not being lovable or not being complete. And also, finally, we don't, in a profound way, we stop taking things for granted the more we see impermanence and that things aren't going to be around forever and that they're not going to be, you know, the thing that answers everything, still we begin to get a much more truer relationship. Again, with the Ajahn Chah, one of my favorite stories, Ajahn Chah had a bunch of students and they all were not allowed to own or have a cup, even with tape with their name on it. They just had to, each day, at the end of the day, wash the cups and the next day get a new one. You guys get tape and your own cup. So, there. Anyway, Ajahn Chah had the Ajahn Chah mug. One day, a student, a student who sounds an awful lot like myself. You should ask Noah what I was like when he came to New York and started teaching. I was like the know-it-all. And the student said to Ajahn Chah, "Why do you get the mug with your name on it and none of us do?" And Ajahn Chah says, "Because I know this mug is already broken and you don't." The aha moment in there is that Ajahn Chah knows that one day he's going to reach for the cabinet, it's going to slip through his hands or somebody's going to have dropped it or it's going to fall on its side and it's going to shatter. He knows it. His relationship with that mug has that deeply experiential wisdom already packed in. And he said, the moment you know that your mug is broken, you'll get one too with your name on it. So that's how we play work and jobs and relationships. For me, it's much more a loving game that we love. But I don't try to get any more that sense of I'm okay from the freelance art direction job or the being able to play a lot of instruments. I don't try to get the love, the feeling that I'm lovable. I don't try to get the ability to turn off my mind and allow the worry to go away from those things. I'm looking for a place that's reliable. So it's finally a balance, seeing this unreliability, this impermanence, this lack of satisfaction, whatever you want to call it, don't worry about the titles. Seeing that things aren't finally the answer gives us permission to move on. It's a balance to concentration. The Buddha saw that not only are these jobs and these things in the world inherently at the end not going to be the answer, but even the things that arise inside of us, the thoughts, the worries, the stories, the plannings. The big thing is if only I figure it out. For a long time, if I only read every book by Jacques Derrida, I would have it all figured out. Then it was Michel Foucault I needed to read every book by. Then it was Jacques Lacan. Then it was this writer, this writer, this writer. I felt if only I just get that next book and read that, and then it became Dharma books. If only I just figure it out, that's going to be the answer. So the thoughts I believed in, that story, like the intellectual thing was going to solve me. Sometimes people really like sense sensations. People can be very tactile and physical, and that's where they're looking for happiness and contact with others. Give me that good feeling. Give me that nice hug. Give me that. Give me it. Give me it. That's not scary, right? Give me it. Everybody's had that moment on retreat where they go, if only I could hug somebody. Because we're still trying to get the answer from out there. If only I got that hug, that really good hug. I still get that. Following my wife around like a creep. Give me the hug. You know? So these very khandhas, these aggregates of the mind, the perceptions, the body sensations, the vedanas, the feelings, everywhere we're looking inside for something that's going to be satisfactory, eventually these things too will eventually fail. But that doesn't mean that there's not an answer. Eventually down the line,
there is actually a real profound peace, which is, again, we experience all these things, we enjoy all these things, but the real answer to that is, how can I feel this feeling? How can I hear the story and let it go? It's observing. It's that part of the mind that stands back and is not, as Pablo was using the example of the person in the chair in the cabin, seeing all the things passing by in the world and the dramas and the nice sensations and the beautiful things and then people who are shouting. It's having the seat that's away from it. That's where the answer is. How can I feel this feeling? How can I let go of this story? How can I feel this feeling that needs to be felt? How can I let go of this story I've been telling myself about myself? So eventually, as we deepen, everything that we see eventually starts becoming, we see it with such this nature of knowing that it's not controllable, not reliable, and that it's not going to be constant, that the Buddha said he moved on to this profound realization that the things that pass through the mind that we attach to for this is who I am, as an answer, well, maybe if I found out who I am, that way I'd have permission to feel better, to let go, to stop, to finally be peaceful. That the things that pass through the mind, we cling to, and we say, well, this must be me, or this must be me. The weird thing about me is I always have a lot of things. I was telling somebody earlier, my mind's capable of a lot of things. I can show up to work and still have a part of me that really is judging, like the people there, and this other part of me is really wanting to be at home playing the banjo. And I often, for a long time, associated the deepest, darkest thing that I wasn't showing people, that has got to be me, because that's the thing I'm upset about, so that has to be me. The person who's showing up for life and, you know, paying the bills that needs to be, that I'm responsible for, that's getting up out of bed and going to work, that's not really me. That's a mask, a facade. That's not really who I am. It's really the dark, ugly thing that's really scared, confused. And then at other times, I've been, oh, it's the Dharma teacher is really me. Cue scary, creepy face. And that all those fear and that anger and that confusion and that still having a lot of problems at times falling into peace, that's not me. I teach at Dharma Punks. That's me. The truth is that we're always changing. You should see the person who I am when I'm hanging out with Pablo. And then the person who I am when I'm listening to interviews, and then the person who I am while I'm talking to you. The person who I am when I'm hanging out with my bros back home or hanging out with Kathy, or the person who's, watching soccer. They're all different. If I talked to my friends the way I talk to people in the interviews, they would say, he's gone and lost his fucking mind. Really, give yourself space to honor and feel this feeling. If I said that to my friend, Cracker, he would literally just lock me up. He would just look at me and just go, dude, I'm not hanging out with you anymore. And interestingly enough, what I'm doing changes who I am. When I'm at work, I'm different. It also goes to not only can't we find a lasting identity, but even the states we experience don't have anything that's a lasting identity in and of itself. I'll give you an example. If I'm really stressed out and then suddenly the stress goes away and I experience peace, Or let's say I experience neutral. How about that? I experience neutral. I've been really stressed out in my stomach, and then the stomach relaxes, and it's neutral. That neutral feeling will feel really great. But if I've been in a really pleasurable state, I'm getting a belly massage. Not that anybody would do such a thing, but I'm getting a belly massage, and then it's ended, and I'm back in neutral. Neutral feels really kind of boring and shitty. So neutral doesn't really have a lasting identity. It's just a passing experience. The same thing with a meditation. If I really want to achieve enlightenment, virtually every single meditation I've had is disappointing. But if I simply want to get a little bit of peace of mind, hope for just a little bit more relaxation, each meditation I've had in this retreat has pretty much been a triumph. So it depends on where we're going, too, that determines how we experience things. In my case, too, and in most people's cases, it depends on how much food I ate, how much sleep I've gotten. If I've not gotten a lot of sleep, a buzzer or that bell that people ring in the morning, it's incredibly early and now we're ringing a bell. That's a horrible sound. But if I've gotten a lot of sleep, it's like, bing, oh, another day. Well, that would never cross my mind. But I'm totally exaggerating. So I got to hurry this up because I'm nearing the cutoff time. So I'm just going to say that the permission to not eventually have to identify with anything and just to view all the things, the person that shows up to work and the person who's frightened and the person who's hanging out with his bros and the person who's, you know, anxious or talking with the relatives, it's liberating to have the ability to know that none of that stuff is truly me. Some people find it scary, but I'll tell you, it's totally liberating. Because anything that's truly me, I am stuck with. If I really believe that inner worry, that inner anxious guy, that inner depressed or anxious or frightened person, that's really me, then I will never really feel that I'll let it go. Because I'll believe that's really me, that person who's hiding behind the social mask. If I really believe that the person who's really smart and comes across as a brainiac is the really me, then the times when I'm really profoundly silly and dumb, they'll be horrifyingly disappointing. And there's so many of them, I don't want to add that kind of. So not taking stuff as me allows me the ability to open to the idea that one day this thing that I'm struggling with, if I give it enough attention, and if I let go of enough stories, maybe eventually this will pass. But it doesn't pass if I really believe that's me. If you find it's too early in the practice to work with not-self, what's known as anatta, don't worry about it. The Buddha actually, before he taught it, actually taught saying, build up a positive sense of self that you don't cling to and be willing when the time is right and it's no longer useful to drop it. So I think of, for a long time, I thought of myself as a really spiritual guy when I was going through depression because that helped me get out of the depression. And then eventually, when I was clinging too long to that story and I saw that it was interfering with friendships and relationships, oh yes, I am the spiritual guy. I know the answer. You're suffering? Come to me. Then it's causing suffering. Then it was time to let go. So what is really important if it's not finding the real me is really important to feel the feelings, let go of the stories, and to truly see the real insight is, what am I doing that is planting the seeds for future happiness? Neurons that fire together, wire together. If I think thoughts of compassion, I'm planting compassion in my mind, and that thought will arise then sometime in the future when something that I normally greet with worry or anger or aggression pops up. I no longer have to worry what's me. I just have to see, is this something that I can see in the long term as something that's going to make my mind a more pleasant place? As the Buddha said to the Kalamas, is greed or anger going to be that thing? And the Kalamas said, no. And he said, that's what you build your spiritual path on. Not anything that I say, not anything that Noah says or Pablo, not anything that you've heard, not anything that anybody else says here, not anything that any book tells you, not anything that you've ever, you know, heard from word of mouth or what everybody else in the world is doing. They might be working towards their 401k plan, but it's when you see that this thing that I'm doing is for my long-term good. It may not work now. It may not work tomorrow. But I have a good hunch. I've seen other people that I trust. I've seen in my past once that it worked. It's not paying off immediately. This exercise is kind of shitty because it's not giving me the muscles immediately. But I'm going to do it. That's what's important. So I'm ending with the thought of, don't worry about anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Don't worry about naming, like, oh, that's not self, or that's suffering. Just work on feeling what needs to be felt, letting go of the story, and bringing the wisdom into seeing what is planting the seeds. What kind of mind do I want to be in the future? And start creating those thoughts. And the thoughts that you don't want to be with in the future, start the process of seeing and opening up to the idea that they're not you and that we can drop it. So that's all the time I have. I really thank you for listening. I really deeply respect your practice in a real deep way. I've been so honored to hear and talk with you, the people I've been able to. It's a deep honor to be able to say some remarks in front of one of my most profound and important people in my life. And I'm just so happy to be here. So thank you. Thank you for having me.